is 3:03 p.m. on Tuesday, May 9th in Capitol Room 106. Try that again. Members present are Representative Eastman, Representative Keto, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Edgman, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Sponholz Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I want to thank Christy Blair, the House Health Secretary from Records, and Danea Burns. All right, thank you, from the Juneau LAO for staffing the committee today. We have one item on the agenda today. That is House Bill 215 by the House Finance Committee. If I can ask Jenny Martin, staff to House Finance Co-Chair Representative Paul Seaton, to come forward, put herself on the record, and recap the bill for the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Jenny Martin, and I am staff for Representative Paul Seaton.
And you are joined by?
Jill Lewis, Deputy Director for the Division of Public Health.
All right. Thank you.
So a few weeks ago, our intern. Again, this is Jenny Martin, staffer representative Paul Seaton. And a few weeks ago, we introduced this bill, HB 215. And this would, it came out of the subcommittee process when they were looking at the indirect expenditure reports and ways to help departments become more self-sufficient. And one of those ways was to help the public health centers to be able to charge fees for things that they haven't been able to charge fees for before, to consider looking into those things. And so this was one of the ways to help do that. As we were looking at the bill and in talking with public health and the Department of Law, we realized that the bill did not it was kind of limiting, and so we have this amendment today to hopefully help us move the bill towards that self-sufficiency that we are looking for. So I was going to go through the amendment, and in your packet you should have gotten the amendment and an explanation, as well as a copy of the current statutes for 3705146.
We want to formally move it for the purposes of discussion before you do that. All right.
Have you moved it then, Madam? Sure.
Yes.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
All right, and that was Amendment 1. The Chair. Yeah, we were moving very quickly there. We're moving Amendment 1, Work Order 30-LS0673/D3. So now you can walk us through.
So, as I said, this amendment, we're looking at trying to work towards the intention of self-sufficiency. And while we were looking at this, one of the examples that Jill from the Department of Health and Social Services from Public Health had noted was data analysis. And Department of Law pointed out that, well, if you wanted to do data analysis, that's under 1808, which would not be allowed under the bill the way we had it written originally. So the amendment is working to correct that problem. And so on page one of the amendment, that is going to broaden the scope instead of limiting it to 1805010. We will be, this is, sorry, let me go back a little bit. Section one of the bill has to do with 3705146C, and this is the definition list of designated general fund. And we need to be able to list these under there so that they can be listed under DGF.
And we're talking about section one of the amendment?
Section, yeah, page one of the amendment, which goes with section one of the bill. And so the original bill has it listed as 1805010, but for the reasons I already stated, that was limiting. And so in this amendment, we'll be replacing 1805010 with the language other public health programs and services, which you can find on line 16 of the amendment on page 1. Now, you'll notice that number 90 is a lot bigger than it originally was in the bill. The reason for that is that while we were working on this amendment, legislative legal brought to our attention that it might be helpful if we consolidated all of the health and social service subsections under one subsection. And so that's why I provided that current list of the 89 things that are listed under 3705146. So the other part of this, page one, is moving those health and social services subsections all underneath the new number 90. And so in your explanation, I have it written out there that number 42 would now become number 90-A, and number 59 would become B, 60 would become C, 61 becomes D, 62, 63, 65, and 66 all become E, 64 becomes F, 67 becomes G, 71 becomes H, and 88 becomes I. And I do have Ledge Legal available on the phone to answer any questions about that. It was their suggestion that it might be helpful to just consolidate that in one area. So that's why that looks a lot bigger than it originally did in the bill. On page two of the amendment, in the original bill, under 4429022A, which is fees for the department, we would, public health, it is already listed that public health and social services can create fees for 4429020A numbers 1 through 8. Public health would also like to add number 14 to that list. And number 14 is the tobacco control programs. And Jill from public health here will be able to answer any questions that you have about why they wanted to add that one on there as well. And then also on page 2, line 8, this is where we're working to address that issue of broadening the scope of what they're able to charge for. So on line 8 of the amendment, we'll be deleting number 1805010 and replacing it with just AS18 so that it'll broaden what they're able to consider charging fees for. And Jill, again, can provide examples of why they wanted to broaden that. The data crunching is just one of those things that they would not have been able to charge for under the way the bill was written before. The last thing at the very bottom of the amendment there is adding a new section 3, which is a repeals section. And basically, it's just repealing all of those subsections that were now consolidated under the 90 subsection. So you can even see the numbers there, 42, 59, 61, etc., that correspond to the explanations that I provided. So that concludes my explanation of the amendment. Jill is here from Public Health to be able to answer questions about the need for this amendment, as well as I said, Ledge Legal is on the line for any questions you might have of them.
Are there any questions for the sponsor, Representative Eastman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I guess, for Jill. Now, the tobacco control program, can you help me understand what those fees would look like? Maybe not necessarily the exact amount, but how would those fees work out, do you expect?
So thank you, Representative Eastman, through the chair. And again, for the record, this is Jill Lewis, Deputy Director for the Division of Public Health. Much of what we do in the way of prevention activities would not be things that we would charge fees for. We wouldn't charge fees for everything we do. But one thing that we could look at doing and have talked about before is for the tobacco control quit line. When someone calls and they want services through the quit line to get nicotine patches or the counseling services and things like that, we currently don't have a way to charge a fee for that. So that limits how much of that service we can actually provide, because we can only provide as much as we can afford to pay out of the tobacco funds that we use to support the program. If we were able to charge fees for those particular individual services, then we might be able to provide more service to more people.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I have a follow-up to that. If
In the example of the tobacco control quit line, it makes a lot of sense to me that you'd be able to charge fees for that. Would you be able to bill insurance, or is this the kind of thing where somebody would have to pay for it and then bill their own insurance? Since a lot of insurance plans cover tobacco cessation, for example.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz. That's an excellent question. We don't have the volume to really set up a third-party billing system. For us, it would be cost prohibitive. We do what's called first-party billing, which means you bill the patient, and the patient can bill the insurance company. They can send their claim into their insurance company for reimbursement, or we accept payment at the time of service. We do that for public health nursing clinics in our public health centers. And so for us, the quit line is more of an administrative cost. But being able to provide that extra bit of service, if we were able, to have that, would still free up funds for us because they would be first-party billing.
Okay. Is there additional questions for Ms. Lewis or for the sponsor? All right. Is there, Representative Edgman, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection.
Is there any further objection to the adoption of this amendment? All right, seeing none, Amendment 1 has been adopted. Are there any further amendments? All right, I think probably at this point in time we need to move to testimony. And I actually don't see anybody that's signed up currently. Is this my... there we go. All right. I'm going to open public testimony, and it looks like we've got Janie Monk in the room. My apologies. I was misreading my iPad here.
Good afternoon. My name is Janie Monk, and I'm Vice President of Policy and Programs with the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association. Thanks for the opportunity to provide some comments on HB 215. And I don't really have any comments on the amendment because I haven't had a chance to look at it in any detail and understand it. But I'll see if I can touch on it a little. At ASHNO, we recognize the serious budget situation facing Alaska and the need to look at to all sides for revenue to support services. And we believe it's appropriate for the Division of Public Health to explore when possible to charge fees for services provided. And in the amendment, if I understand, I like the concept of putting fees into designated funds so they can go back into those programs. So the whole concept we support. However, we are concerned at the broad latitude the bill gives the division, especially in the area of regulatory compliance. The bill gives the Division of Public Health authority to charge fees for the administration of public health programs under AS 180501, and now on the amendment, I think even broader, broader latitude. So this is very broad. I was going to say it's a very broad statute and allows them to charge fees in a very broad way. And what I believe the amendment did is broaden that even further. We are concerned that currently there's a list in statute of services where fees can be charged. And these fees have gone through a public legislative process and people have had a chance to comment. We recognize that this does limit the division in the ability to charge fees, but it does provide for a public process and give people a way to comment. Specifically, in our experience, the regulatory and budget processes alone are often insufficient to provide appropriate oversight to what fees the division could impose, and particularly what compliance programs they could build up with new revenue. Once the regulation process is underway, there really isn't a good opportunity for meaningful dialogue on the impact of what's being proposed. So we realize that public comment is always an option during the regulation process, but it often comes too late. And by the time we have a chance to comment, the regulations have already been drafted and kind of the train's left the station. So we are willing to work with the division over the interim to ensure that there are, we'd like to see them have the authority to charge fees where appropriate, but want to make sure there's appropriate sideboards to protect healthcare providers and the public from unnecessary and growing regulatory and cost burdens. So I'll give just a couple examples to help you understand what I'm trying to explain. So one priority given by the division in their briefing paper is for radiological device fees to support a second radiological health physicist for registration, certification, and inspection of radiology devices, such as MRI and CT. Currently, only X-ray devices are registered and certified and inspected by the state. So ASHNA strongly supports efforts to make care safer for patients, but we don't know if there's evidence to demonstrate that charging fees to find a state employee to inspect devices will increase patient safety, or if it just adds to the regulatory burden and expense. So what isn't stated in that is that in 2012, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, CMS, requires the accreditation of advanced diagnostic imaging equipment, so MRIs and CTs, in order for those providers to bill Medicare. So there are three national accreditation organizations that provide for the review and accreditation. So we question if it's necessary for the state to inspect these devices if providers must already pay for an accreditation organization to review their safety and practices. So this is just an example of the kind of discussion that would need to happen before the division decides to institute a fee to pay for regulatory compliance. We're concerned that additional costs could be charged to providers for these kind of things, and they would be passed on to employers and consumers at a time when there's a lot of attention at healthcare cost and affordability. So we just want to be sure there's a process so that there's evidence, particularly when we talk about regulatory compliance, that this is an evidence-based practice and not simply a new regulatory requirement with a fee attached. Another example that they've talked about in the briefing paper is allowing public health to charge a fee for statistical analysis and epidemiological analysis on public health data sets. And we support this concept to allow enhanced use of the data set. However, we're concerned that this could result in data only being available in a pay-to-play type system. So regulations related to charging fees would need to ensure that those providers that are doing the work to submit the data to the public health system have access to the data. And they shouldn't have to pay to get access to data that they are submitting. So access to the health facilities data reporting program, which is one of the ones they're talking about charging fees, is already a problem for hospitals. So we're concerned about looking to charging fees as the primary solution. So these examples are really just to highlight our overall concern that the legislation as written gives the division very broad latitude to impose new fees without providing a sufficient opportunity for those who will be charged fees to be involved in the process. So if fees were to be established for the activities outlined in the briefing paper or any other ideas like tobacco program, we'd want to ensure that there's an opportunity for meaningful stakeholder involvement from the beginning of the process, not just once regulations for the fees are issued. So again, we're willing to work with the division, but without these kinds of things in place, we cannot support this legislation. And we have been in touch with the department on our concerns, so they are aware of it.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. You mentioned as far as the fees, the radiological fees, when a facility has an MRI or a CAT scan, number one, you say there's a federal oversight. Is that on-site oversight or?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I don't know all of the details about that, but it is not on it's how the device is licensed and accredited. So the facility has to go through a process that is outlined by the at the federal level to ensure the safety and the protection of the equipment. So it's not there are people on site who inspect and operate the equipment, and their qualifications are part of what is reviewed.
Okay, thank you. I just forgot my second question.
Yeah, thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. Just to kind of follow up from that question. So as you've discussed about having a federal oversight for management or what have you for these radiological pieces,
So what you're saying is then that we have duplicate oversight then, where state is overseeing it and federal as well? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Through the chair, Silverman, that would be what would happen if the state decided to charge a fee to license and inspect these devices that are already being accredited by the federal government. So that duplication does not exist now, but one of the proposed fees, we believe, could result in duplication of expense and work for facilities that have this equipment. And it may be, I had shared this information with Jill Lewis this morning, and it may be that when this proposal was written, they didn't realize what the federal, it's a complicated field, and they may not have realized what existing regulations are already in place.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, are there any specific proposals you might have in mind as far as how to change the current bill to address the concerns you raised?
I don't have any right now. We've had some initial conversations that there could be some kind of pre-regulation process, or once they go into the regulation process, there's no conversation and dialogue allowed. So some process before regulations are written that would allow stakeholders to have a dialogue. And we would be open to suggestions, and that's why we suggest some meetings during the interim to talk about what options would be available.
Thank you.
All right. I have a couple of questions. You mentioned that there are there are institutions in the state which are being accredited nationally in order to receive compensation from Medicaid. Do you know if that covers all MRI and other radiologic?
Again, I don't know all the details, but all hospital there's a variety of different accreditation mm-hmm. requirements depending on what services a facility provides. So the whole accreditation conversation is pretty detailed, and it's not my area of expertise. I just did a little bit of research on the radiological. I was curious because I thought it was interesting that right now the state is inspecting and licensing X-ray equipment, mm-hmm. But they're not doing that for the other advanced imaging. And so I was kind of curious about that.
And we received testimony that they have been earlier that they had been doing the X-ray equipment because they were given the authority to do that some time ago, and that they didn't have all of the authority and the funding necessary to do it since the explosion of MRI and other imaging equipment that has taken place. So it may be that they wasn't that they didn't intend to do it, mm-hmm. but that they didn't have the potential, they didn't have the authority to do it. I'm concerned that there may be some, that there are MRIs and other imaging equipment out there that is not in these accredited facilities, which may not be inspected. I certainly know that, members of ASHNA are, because you're working hard to be accredited so that you can continue to bill Medicaid and Medicare, you're going to be adhering to standards which are much higher than, smaller operations which may, exist in different parts of the state which have very little oversight, and excluding eliminating the authority from the department to be able to do that kind of inspection for a more targeted population because you don't need it may not be wise.
Well, and just to clarify, I am in no way advocating that we not do everything possible to ensure safe care for patients. What I am suggesting is we don't want the ability to charge fees to be what drives the first question is, what do we need to do to ensure that these equipment is safe for patients? Mm-hmm. And is that obligation being met through other things? Or, like you said, are there some piece of equipment that are not mm-hmm. Being inspected adequately? Mm-hmm. And then if that answer is yes, there are ones that are not being inspected, by all means, we should look at that. Mm-hmm. But that kind of dialogue, so our bigger concern is whether those important conversations will occur mm-hmm. Prior to a regulation process, or whether we could inadvertently end up with double regulations because now the department has the ability to charge fees to do things, mm-hmm. and we don't want the fees to drive we want evidence-based practices to drive what we're doing.
So the second thing that you said that I had a question about was you made a comment about expressing concern about the sort of pay-to-play scenario where only those that could afford to pay for data analysis would be able to participate, and that others wouldn't be able to participate. In your comments around that section, you indicated that there's been trouble getting data from the department, getting data back. Sometimes data that you're providing information to the department to complete a data set. Did you say that you have been having difficulty getting that data set back in an unanalyzed format?
The program I'm referring to is the Health Facilities Data Reporting Program, and that program mandates that all hospitals and nursing homes, ambulatory surgery centers, imaging centers submit data on all of their discharges, and that data is assembled into a large data set. And facilities currently, it's interesting because currently facilities and ASHNA, according to the data agreement, can request the data set and get access to it, but the cost is $2,000. And so ASHNA certainly can do that, but Petersburg Medical Center is a very small facility that's submitting their data, but they don't have they can't afford to pay, nor do they have the analytical capabilities to use that. So we have requested kind of a standard set of reports or some access to the data outside of paying for it be available. So it's interesting that they use this example because they are already charging for that data set, and there must be some different mechanism that allows them to charge for the data set but not for the analysis of the data is what I'm imagining. And what the smaller facilities who don't have that capacity need is for there to be some to turn that big giant data set into some sort of information that is useful, and right now that is not happening. And we've been working with the program recently moved over to Vital Statistics, and we've been working with them, and and they are agreeable but don't have the staff capacity. And so our concern is then if they have to charge facilities to get back data that they're submitting to provide a complete data set.
Okay. Another question, but I lost my question. I guess the other question that I had was about the regulatory process. And you said that you didn't feel that that there was enough opportunity to participate as an external stakeholder in the regulatory process. You wouldn't have an opportunity to provide feedback at the time at which it's really valuable. Could you describe that a little bit? Is there a specific example that you could give me where you felt like you weren't able to participate until it was too late and the ship had sort of left, of course, it left the barn? Maybe.
Well, there's always a public comment period for regulations. And so once the regulations are drafted, they're released, and there's usually at least a 30-day public comment period. And then the department can take those comments, and they can integrate them or they can ignore them. I mean, they get to choose what to do with it. But it's not a dialogue process. It's a we give you comments and you listen, and then they go back and decide what to do. And so prior to them the regulations being issued into the formal process, prior to them being drafted is really where we feel like there needs to be the dialogue and the input to make sure they're drafted in the way that best meets the needs of all of those impacted. And there certainly is an they could do it. And I think the current administration generally does. But we're concerned that people change, general practices change, and if the legislation doesn't actually outline a requirement to do that in the future, we don't know what will happen. And so it's not so much a concern about the existing administration or what's happening right now. It's more of just an awareness that once those regulations are issued in draft form, there is no conversation, and we want to be part of a conversation when fees are being discussed.
All right. Thank you. Is there any other questions for Ms. Monk? All right. Thank you for your testimony today. All right. I thought we were going to have some additional testimony today, but it doesn't look like we do. Is there anybody else that I'm missing? All right, seeing none. Ms. Lewis I'm sorry, Ms. Martin, did you guys want to proceed forward? I was trying to remember your last name, Jenny. Did you want to come forward? Do you have any additional comments that you wanted to make currently in response to any of the comments or anything?
So again, for the record, Jill Lewis, Deputy Director for the Division of Public Health. Just to address a few of the comments that Ms. Monk made and maybe clarify a little bit and provide a little bit of background, we're not looking to broaden our regulatory authority, and we don't believe the bill as written would accomplish that. It would work within our existing authority for the things that we already do and are able to do. That includes the radiologic device oversight that we would have. We already have the statutory authority to do it. We haven't implemented regulations to do it because we haven't got the commensurate fee authority and haven't identified a different way to pay for that. So for us, the need exists. If someone, you know, we're not anxious to charge fees, and we know no one really wants to pay for fees. But we recognize that with the current budget situation, you know, public health is not free health care. And where there's an ability to pay and it makes economical sense and it doesn't undermine our public health mission or the public interest, then it's incumbent upon us to try and be more self-sufficient. And this would be one area that typically inspections are something that tends to be fee-based or fee-based in other states. In reference to some of the federal accreditation and how that would overlap, we definitely would look into that more. Since we don't already have the regulations to do those MRI and CT devices, that would be the first step, is going through a process to do those regulations. And that would include wrapping in what the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services includes in their accreditation. But accreditation is periodic, and it tends to look more at whether or not you have the proper policies, procedures, and basics in place, and it isn't there to validate your compliance with those or to do interim checks, and isn't something that's going to be as in-depth. They're not going to sit down and review your records to see how, you know, if there were any events or things like that. It wouldn't serve any particular purpose for us to duplicate that if there are elements that are being done already. Then we could focus on the elements that are not being done, to me would be a more efficient way to look at it, is how could we knit those together. One of the things that Ms. Monk had talked about and we have discussed is getting together in the interim and discussing how we can better improve the process. And, you know, we're very open to doing that. We want an open and public process. We are very happy to discuss with them and all the stakeholders how we would go about doing any kind of fees and, you know, what is the cost benefit of them and the burden that it would place on the different stakeholders. The stakeholder for a community health needs assessment might not be the same stakeholder for MRI inspections. So, you know, we would need to have a fair number of meetings and discussions in order to set those up. And that's one of the reasons why in the fiscal note it's sort of put out an extra year, is because that whole first year would be in trying to get that kind of input, so that we would know, in fact, what is the best way to approach each of these and what is a reasonable fee, which is what we're mandated to do. Look to see if there was anything I haven't answered. In regards to the health facility discharge reporting, the reason that we're able to do fees for that is because actually they have moved into the health analytics and vital records section, the Bureau of Vital statistics, and they have the authority to charge fees. That particular branch of public health does have authority to charge fees. And so they were able to institute a fee system, but it's not my understanding that we're charging a fee for a facility to get back the facility's own data. If the facility wants access to all of the data set from all of the facilities or additional analysis, then that would be something different. And that kind of, I can understand that concern, because I would tend to agree with Ms. Monk that the mandatory reporters should have as an expectation something that we give them back, that access to their own data and a set of baseline reports that we provide everyone, and then the custom analyses or more in-depth regional reports, something special, is what we would look at.
Are there any questions? Oh, all right. Representative Sullivan.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Yes.
yes, please. I'd like to get back to the inspection and certification for radiological devices. I know when you were here last, Ms. Lewis, we had talked about that, and kind of my understanding was that there was not anyone or any group presently that oversaw the equipment across the state and in our public facilities. And so, you know, listening to other testimony, I now hear that there is a federal oversight. And I do remember just, you know, in my own work at the hospital setting, that JCO would come through to do the accrediting process. So my question is then, have we had federal oversight then for the equipment that you've talked about? And am I missing a piece of the puzzle here?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, it's not my area of expertise, but what I understand is that the accreditation that we're talking about is to accredit the facility. It's not about the individual machines and the safety of the individual machines. And so that is a key piece of the distinction. Mm-hmm. They certainly are doing things to make sure, you know, as part of that accreditation process, there are elements that they are going through to check and make sure that there is some safety elements. And there are statements in that accreditation, the standards that they set, that you comply with federal and state law for what are those standards. So they don't set that detailed standard. They set a more general standard that needs to be met. And so the state would be the one who would be doing that, and we would be the ones looking at the actual machines and the devices, whereas they're looking at accrediting the facilities.
Madam Chair, just for follow-up, so they don't come through and inspect the machinery that we have for MRIs, CTs, and what have you, and that's what you're seeking. Then our fees, so that you may get a healthcare specialist that can come and actually oversee those radiological devices to make sure they're within compliance?
Through the Chair, Representative Sullivan, my understanding is that they would check to make sure policies and procedures were in place and that certain equipment was there, but they're not going to test the machine, calibrate it. They're not going to run the machine and do that kind of thing. That's the kind of thing that we would do.
Thank you. I was looking for that distinction. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, what exactly is driving the desire to do this since it's not currently being done? Are you receiving complaints? Are there instances of abuse? What's driving it?
Through the Chair, Representative Eastman, are you speaking about the fees in general, or are you speaking more specifically about the radiologic devices?
More specifically on the current radiological devices.
Well, it kind of goes back to what Representative Sponholz said, that there's been a proliferation of these devices, and in our efforts to bring them into our fold of looking at them to register them and certify them and then inspect them is we discovered that we lacked certain capacity to be able to follow up on that. And so it's long been something that we've been trying to do. And we'll do a cursory inspection of the CTs while we're there. It's a kind of an unofficial one. We'll look at them and give feedback to the sites. But it's not part of the
the actual regulatory process because of some of those limits.
Follow up through the chair. It's my understanding that many, perhaps even all of these devices, since they are usually pretty expensive devices, have service contracts associated and have, you know, the manufacturers that can come by and provide service and provide calibration on a periodic basis. What is it about the current federal certification process and those types of, you know, service plans that is not achieving the goal?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I will try and address that question. The manufacturers could come and adjust the machine, but they're not going to be testing it for compliance, and they're not going to be validating that compliance. And there might be a question of a conflict of interest for them to be doing that work. That's not to say that that's not something that we could look at as to how we could address that. And if there's an opportunity to make use of them in the, you know, in the process moving forward.
Okay.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. I was going to get into the service management part of it as well, because I've worked a little bit with the contracts on those with GE and what have you. And what I remember was that, you know, if something broke down, they're going to come and do the repair. They're not going to do the calibrations of how each procedure is done. That's done by a specialist, but the contracts are done separate. So I was trying to think of it in my head, and I needed to say it out loud at the same time. But you kind of answered my question, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. You know what? I realized that I did not close public testimony, so I'm going to go ahead and do that now. I'm interested in finding out if there's any other questions for Ms. Lewis. Seeing none, I'm interested in finding out sort of what the will of the committee is at this point in time. I think my initial thoughts on this are that we've asked the department, and we've asked all departments throughout the state, to try to come up with creative new ways to diversify their funding, to come up with ways that are more entrepreneurial while still working within their sort of regulatory limitations. And this is one way that the Department of Public Health has done that by working with the sponsor to try to come up with some creative ways that are constructive and practical. There's some pretty clear sideboards, I think, actually, with regard to your authority to do these things, knowing that we have, as per your testimony in a previous hearing, you know, a limitation. You can't charge more than it costs to provide a service you're interested in safety, and you've described sort of looking for creative solutions and not necessarily having to be the one that does those things necessarily in every case. But I do see also a real concern for me in the fact that we aren't testing MRI and other imaging equipment in the state of Alaska. That concerns me a great deal. This is equipment that while helping to illuminate the pursuit of health, could also be very dangerous for the people that use it, for the people that are that it's being used on, and so I'm glad to see that you've come up with a proposal to advance this. I know that there was some concerns expressed by Ashton, and I think some of those concerns are really valid in terms of wanting to make sure that there's enough collaboration in the process. It seems to me that I'm hearing from you, Ms. Lewis, that you have a lot of intention to collaborate, and I haven't heard any concerns that from Ashton that you're not willing to, that the department isn't willing to collaborate, fee development process will be long. It will not be a quick sort of rush to, and as the legislative process is also an iterative and long process, which is starting for this particular bill with this committee, I'm inclined to
you know, keep advancing it to give you the chance to work with ASHNA on developing, you know, sort of refinements to the bill that might improve it, but to keep it moving along at this point in time. I don't know if there are concerns from the committee that you feel strongly need to be addressed before we move it along. Okay. Why don't you do that? Representative Eastman?
As I kind of look at the calendar and end of session and the fact that we are looking to make changes to this proposal, I don't know that there's any reason to rush it along at this point. Perhaps we came back first part of next session when the other body's also hearing it, because I don't think they are right now. That might be a good time to evaluate what you guys come up with.
Is there any other comments? All right. So if there were one, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 215, Work Order 30-LS0673-D. It's amended. Move it from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? All right, seeing none, committee substitute for HB 215 passes from committee. We're going to, we will ask everybody to stay after committee to sign the paperwork. Mr. Madsen is running to grab the bill packet right now. The time is 3:49, and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.